Similarly with the problem of happiness, of well-being, if we truly understand our unhappiness, our illness, then happiness, the question of happiness and of well-being, no more presents a problem. And since our wrong approach stems fundamentally from our basic ideas, in fact so basic that they are the underground, invisible foundation of our mental functioning. Since they stem from that sort of basis, it becomes necessary to look into this very basis. See? And to find out just how we have gone wrong in interpreting the scriptures. We have misinterpreted all along the line. And this misinterpretation is due partly to the fact that those who taught us, brought us up, conditioned us, were themselves quite ignorant. I mean literally quite ignorant. That's one aspect of it. And secondly, the actual verbal formulations are so faulty that they are misleading. They mislead us all along the line. Take for example the simple phrase, in the beginning. You will find this phrase in most of the scriptures of the world. And of course, the reader, as well as the expounder, interprets it as something in time, something which started, something which got made in the beginning. Well, obviously, our whole life experience in the ordinary sense, in the ordinary way, makes us use the word beginning and the phrase in the beginning in relation to the making or emergence of something limited and particular. And we have this phrase in the beginning. And then we read that this power of God or being or whatever it is created this, then he created that, then he created this, and so forth and so forth and so forth. And all the world comes into existence. And this is the being or power that controls us, guides us, and with which we must attain an ultimate relationship of perfection or a union, as the mystics would say, and all the rest of it. Now, as we have considered in past meetings, this is hopelessly wrong. The phrase in the beginning means that state of your own awareness when you have realized the transcendent condition. And the transcendent condition is one in which the mind is completely denuded, completely cleared out of all. Denuded of all concepts, ideas, beliefs, conclusions, and so on. The mind has to be in the state of utter purity, which means utter emptiness. It is in that state that it is really luminous. Now, in this connection, for a moment, consider what we usually feel with respect to the word mind. We say the mind or my mind, as if it was some sort of immaterial container. That is how we really feel about it. It's an immaterial container. It's a mysterious money box which I possess. You see? Hello, do come in. You'll find the chairs at the back there, or here if you like. Do come in. Frank, could you come a little forward, please? Will you be careful not to scratch the piano? The last two Saturdays, chairs have touched the piano and scratched it. Yes, you see. Sorry to worry you about that, but there we are. Now. So this misconception of the mind has to disappear. It's not a bag in which thoughts, feelings, ideas are put. It's not a kind of an invisible machine, a ghost machine, which thinks, as we say, and solves problems and so forth. Nothing of the sort. The mind is this extraordinary, receptive, responsive sensitivity of the living organism. It's a sensitivity of the living organism. And as such, it is not something limited, particular, possessed by the organism. It is a quality of the organism. It is a characteristic of it, of the living organism, which we call the human being. See, we have to appreciate this fact. So now, what is the meaning of the empty mind? It simply means that the living person is well aware that all concepts, ideas, beliefs are only temporary pictures which are made by the person. And they do not, they are not in themselves actual truth. The actual fact, the actual truth, is something which we do not know. We cognize only our mental images of the actual truth, of the actual fact, whether it be physical or whether it be psychological or whatever it is. And the particular mental images that we store up depends upon our own seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, etc., and then talking about it in the brain. Our speech faculty comes to play upon it. And it is this activity of the speech faculty which constitutes the major part of our mental processes. And we say that, oh, my mind has been at work. Not at all. I have merely been chattering away. Now, the way I chatter is conditioned by everyone around me from my infancy onwards. My parents, my friends, and my teachers, all other human beings, and so on and so on. Books, pictures, etc. So now, when I become really aware of this, I see that this is the fact of what happens with the living organism, myself, or yourself, as we call it. Then, in that condition, with that intense awareness, it is possible to be at least somewhat free from the binding influence, the conditioning influence of all our beliefs, conceptions, thoughts, etc. You see? And then, we do not try to fit in life in the immediate now into the framework of those rigid, fixed ideas, beliefs, etc. Ideas and so on we shall always have, of course, but provided they just emerge and pass away immediately, it's all right. Then they do not restrict. The ideas, thoughts, etc. are the expressions of the living being and the living mind. That means there's something thrown out, pressed out, expressions. They are, the, in a sense, the mental counterpart of the body's excreta. That's exactly what they are. But we cling to them. We hold on to them. Oh, this is precious stuff. Got a wonderful idea. And then that idea stays for 20, 30, 50 centuries, dominating and limiting man. This is the trouble. But when we are really aware of the living process of the living being, that he is all the time, because he is living and conscious, all the time throwing out ideas, he can let them go. And he is not bound by them. He is open. His sensitivity functions unhindered. This receptive, responsive sensitivity functions unhindered. And in that unhindered functioning, life has a chance to flower out into its beauty, its perfection, its wholeness, and all the rest of it. So now, let's get back to this basic conditioning. We have talked a little bit about this phrase, in the beginning. See? So in the beginning stands for that state of transcendent awareness, which is neither consciousness nor unconsciousness as we understand it. It is a state in which one is fully awake. One is alert, one is completely sensitive, but free from all limited, particular thoughts, feelings, ideas, and so on. This is an extraordinary state to be in. It is a state which has always been affirmed, positively affirmed, as being utterly blissful. Utterly free. This is the only real bliss, the only real freedom which cannot be touched by any of the forces in our ordinary everyday life which make for our pleasure or pain, our sorrow or joy. It is transcendent to it all. Alright, now, as we come back from that state, once again images arise. And the images which arise will of necessity depend upon the conditioning we have had before we realize the transcendent awareness. Because they constitute the material, the talking material. Because from that transcendent state, whatsoever happens afterwards, there is the talking process immediately in motion. There is a talking process. Words are given. That's how in Genesis, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Words. But words which have a tremendous symbolical meaning. And if one penetrates into the symbolism, one discovers what they all stand for in terms of the processes which take place in our own minds in everyday life. I'd like to read something from the Subala Upanishad here. It is one of the very little known Upanishads. Generally, you won't find it in the usual translations of the volumes of the Upanishads. This is Radha Krishnan's translation. There is a very good one by Narayan Swami Iyer, which is one of the oldest in existence, translations into English, which I have. And of course, so you can read the original Sanskrit, if you like. Now, you know, scholars have always declared that the subject of the Upanishads is the ultimate reality, the ultimate origin. Ultimate reality. As if it was something which could be pursued by man as he is and discovered. as if it is something which would be the end point of a process of logical thought or of some sort of curious psychical experience in a trance state or whatever it is, or which could be the result of metaphysical speculation. All this is nonsense. It is the complete denuding of all this, the removal of all this, if one may so call it, dirt. You see, it is a consequence of removing all this dirt that ultimately that pure, clean state supervenes in the beginning, the ultimate reality. That ultimate reality is your state of awareness. This is the important point to remember, and this is quite contrary. What I'm saying is quite contrary to all the beliefs held all over the world by people. I dare say there may be some who would be in line with this sort of presentation, but I have never come across in writing or in anybody speaking just this sort of thing, which I'm saying now. That it is your state of awareness which is God, which is Brahman, which is Atma, which is the ultimate ineffable beatitude. And returning from that state, once again, a world evolves, a psycho-spiritual world which is in my brain and nowhere else, doesn't exist outside here. This which exists outside here is derived from, the Indians were pleased to call it Mula Prakruti, root nature, primordial nature. Some use the term Akasha, you see. But with the suggestion, the underlying suggestion, that this is something which is not of the world of the spirit, but of the world of matter, the root of matter. Root matter. Now here there is a flaw which was inevitable in those days. In those days, in ordinary mental processes, it was impossible for people to not to talk of matter and spirit as different and opposed to each other. Today, modern science has done something which enables me anyway, to state positively that there is only one total reality which I, because of my mental processes and the way my mind functions, have split up into spirit and matter. You see? Body and mind. In actuality, there is only one total absolute reality. And it is I who split it up continuously. But I have no evidence in the ordinary way that with modern science dematerializing matter with its own researchers gives one the opportunity to state that there is only one reality and the separation takes place in my mind and not in actual fact. Now those people realizing the transcendent awareness, in the state of transcendent awareness, were unaware of matter as we call matter, were unaware of what we are pleased to call mind. To them it was a transcendent condition. And to us, if and when we enter into that, it is a transcendent condition where there is no division, no separation. You see? But when we come back, if we have this modern knowledge which we have, then we are not caught in the trap of splitting up matter and mind, spirit and this world and so forth. You see? So now, look. The subject then of ultimate reality, which they named Brahman, if the inquiry was what is ultimate reality, which is posed as a philosophical question, and if the inquiry was posed as a psychological problem, what am I? The answer was Atma. And again, as far as I'm aware, no one has ever put this up. Because Brahman is reached by the individual in the profoundest meditation in identically the same way as Atma is reached, asking different questions and arriving at the identical state of consciousness in the identical manner. Therefore, they quite legitimately said Brahman and Atma are identical. Therefore, they said Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, which of course your theistic theologian spits at. He says, this is the most devilish conceit that has ever afflicted man. But the dear theologian is a mere talker. He doesn't know what he's chattering about. He's never entered into any of the deep states of consciousness. He's studied. He has talked. He has discussed. He has followed authority. His mind is like an old fossil which would crack if you tapped it with a wooden mallet, even, leave alone a sledgehammer. Therefore, he can't say anything different from what he does say. But this is the fact. Aham Brahmasmi. It's a simple fact. There is no sacrilege involved in it. There is no conceit involved in it. And so forth. So now, coming back from this state, starts off the disciple's name is Subala, and in this Upanishad, which is put in the form of the divine dialogue, the one who answers is Brahma, the first person of the Trinity, God the Father, the Creator. You see? And you may remember I have explained that in the Upanishads, just as in the Old Testament, where you find the divine dialogue, in the Old Testament you have, so-and-so was moved by the Spirit of the Lord, or the angel of the Lord came and spoke to him. Now, but it simply means that you are in such a state of awareness that this dialogue which takes place inside your own brain is given this particular form because of the particular characteristics of what comes out in that dialogue. If certain characteristics come out, you attribute it to God the Father. If other characteristics, God the Son. Other characteristics, God the Holy Ghost. You see the point? And this is what we find through and through the Upanishads. It was out of the Upanishads that I was able to understand this at all, how it comes, and several things which come out in the Buddha's dialogues, when he talks with Brahma, Sahampati, and so forth, and all the rest of it. Now, so Subala says, what was there then, the word then, the equivalent of in the beginning, what was there in the state of transcendent awareness? Subala himself has entered that state. And in the state of ordinary consciousness, it is he himself giving the answer. But he puts it into the mouth of Brahma, God the Father. All right. And the answer is, it was not existent, not non-existent, neither existent and non-existent. In other words, what we call the manifest, the unmanifest. Nothing of this sort was there. These are all concepts. From that emerged darkness. Now, Radhakrishnan has used the word darkness to translate tamas. Tamas undoubtedly means darkness. That's one of its meanings. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, you have that famous prayer, asatoma sadgamaya, tamasoma jyotirgamaya, mrityor mam amrutam gamaya. From the unreal, lead me to the real, it's usually translated. I prefer to translate it as, from incomplete being, lead me to complete being, to perfect being. We can talk about it some other day. Then, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, from darkness, lead me to light. From death, lead me to immortality. from death, lead me to not death, the deathless state, literally translated. It's in the Brihadaranyaka, which is one of the greatest of the Upanishads. Now, tamas, darkness. Tamas also means inertia. If you want to put it, express it in modern English with a scientific bias to it, prefer the term inertia. Because it is this quality of inertia which makes possible any sort of material manifestation. Scientists say that this mysterious, totally unknown thing which they term energy, some mysterious way appears as a proton and as an electron. And when proton and electron are sufficiently close to each other, the first hydrogen atom is there. A hydrogen atom is there. But the moment you have hydrogen atom, you've got mass, you've got density, you've got inertia at work. So this inertial force, if you like, is a translation which would be a very modern translation of tamas. See? And it's rather interesting that from that transcendent state there emerged inertia. From inertia, the subtle elements. From the subtle elements, akasha, which is, he translates as ether, the old-fashioned word ether, but in modern times we've completely thrown out the word ether. It just means nothing at all. There's no such thing as the postulated ether. But akasha is a very difficult word to translate altogether. One of its meanings is space. Another meaning is sky. You may regard akasha philosophically as both simultaneously the limitless void and also the conditioned fullness. And after all, just words, what do they mean? You have to meditate upon this and get the feel of it. Alright. From akasha, air, air, fire, fire, water, water, earth. Now we know for an obvious fact that fire doesn't come out of water, and earth doesn't come out of, no, I beg your pardon, it's the other way around. From air, fire. Out of air we don't get fire, out of fire we don't get water, and out of water we don't get earth. I mean, this is the old-fashioned way of talking. What they call the elements in those days, fire, air, earth and water, which subsisted right up to the Middle Ages, the elements out of which the world was created, this external world, you see. They are not elements at all. Today we'll talk of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen and so forth. But now you see, the moment consciousness comes back and begins to function in the ordinary way, the images with which we are cognizant here are the very images which are used to represent that return. With a difference. For those people, fire, air, earth, water represented not only fire, air, earth, water as we experience it in physical life, everyday life, but they also represented modes of consciousness of greater or lesser subtlety or refinement. They also represented that. We talk about the fire of inspiration. We talk about the milk of human kindness. We use idiomatic expressions like that, don't we? So there are correspondences to psychical states implied in all this. Then there came into being the egg, this wonderful egg, which they call the golden egg sometimes, Hiranya Garbha, which also means the golden womb. Hiranya is golden, Garbha is womb, the golden womb, you see. Now, this golden womb, this egg, this world egg, you will find in all the mythologies of the world. It comes not merely in the teachings of great religions, but scattered throughout all the religious teachings of the world, this mysterious golden egg. Now, that egg, after incubation for a year, split in two, the lower one being the earth, the upper one being the sky. Now, just let me see what word he actually uses for sky. Ah, yes. Adhishtad bhumin aparishtad akasha. Uses the word akasha again. This curious word which stands for this primordial energy out of which all the material world emerges. That is worked out in other systems of Hindu philosophy, how it emerges, you see. In the middle, between the two parts, earth and sky, there came into being the divine person. Very interesting. The person with 1,000 heads, 1,000 eyes, 1,000 feet, and 1,000 arms. This person created death, the foremost of all beings, the three-eyed, three-headed, and three-footed, and the name given is Khandaparashu. It's just a Sanskrit term. Of him, Brahma, the divine person, became afraid. Now, if we may digress just a moment, it's rather interesting. The lower part of the egg is denominated earth, the upper part is denominated akasha, the heaven, the sky. You find in Genesis, in the beginning, created the heaven and the earth. You find the same thing here in this Upanishad. But this divine person is in the middle between the two, and he creates death. What is the implication? Death has meaning only in relation to the finite, to the limited and the particular. Death has no meaning whatsoever in relation to the infinite. The infinite doesn't die. Similarly, the infinite can never be born. The totality, the one total reality, is neither born, neither is born, nor does it die. It is only when you get this personalistic concept, this idea of the individual, particular being who is conscious, that the whole story of birth and death starts. So, God the Father becomes afraid of death. Of him, Brahma became afraid. But who is Brahma? Not a person outside. It is in my brain. I, Subala, coming back out of that state of transcendent consciousness, begin to become self-conscious as a separate being named Subala. And I am the creator of this whole psycho-spiritual world of mine. And by the misfortune, which I cannot escape, of analogical thinking, I say that this divine person creates all this material universe also, because I have no other explanation to offer. Instead of saying I don't know, all the old scriptures made these statements, which have no validity or no truth in themselves. Why do I say because that they have no validity or truth in themselves? Because when you go make the journey the other way, to the transcendent awareness, you make it only by negating all this, by denying it. This is precisely how it was done through the ages. I hope you are sort of getting the real point of it all. You see, what I'm trying to do is to help all of us, myself included, to get completely free of this fundamental conditioning that lies at the very root of our total being all through our life. This basic other power, other world, you see, which is postulated the perfect, the resplendent, the wonderful, the desirable. And these are all unfortunate postulations because they only express my own ignorance and weakness of reality. If we can be free of that, if we can really get free of it, see that this which lies right within the depths of our consciousness, in the hidden recesses, in the hiddenmost recesses of the mind, if we can really see that, then we can approach our moment-to-moment life as human beings. Clean, simple, good human beings. Until then we can't. Until then every approach is bedeviled by these conceptions, these ideas, these fixed ideas. No. I mean, as I speak, after all, what I'm saying is a string of ideas, isn't it? A string of thoughts, obviously. That is inevitable. Whether you are talking with others or whether you are, as you say, quiet because you're chattering inside yourself. You see? You'll have the string of ideas. But if the ideas fulfilled their proper purpose, namely to leave you in the intelligent, awakened state, aware of the illusions and delusions, then all the ideas put forth in all the religions of the world have fulfilled their real purpose. But until we see that they are but fossils, that it is their negation which is the truth, which is the reality, until we see that, these ideas will always bind us. Alright, see what a lot can come out of just a sentence of the scriptures. All the scriptures of the world are like that. They also have a certain amount of nonsense in them, but that doesn't matter. Of him Brahma became afraid. He got hold of Brahma alone, that is death. Thereupon, he, Brahma, created 7 sons out of his mind. These 7 created in their turn out of their minds 7 sons filled with truth. You find this peculiar presentation of the mind-born sons of Brahma. And always this figure 7 or the figure 10. You'll either find the 10 progenitors or the 7 and so on and so on. There's a lot involved in all this, a sort of a arbitrary psycho-cosmical system, you see. But it is all something which is just put together, made by the mind of man, and presented in a form which will bear a certain amount of correspondence with our ordinary physical life. The word 7 obviously bears correspondence with the days of the week. And the days of the week are the days of the week simply because the moon has its 4 phases in 28 days. You see, and each phase lasts the 7 days, and so forth. There are all sorts of things like that, but we needn't worry about that. These are verily these sons of Brahma, and there each of them has seven sons. No one mentions who their wives were, but still. These are verily the Prajapatis. Pati means lord, that means, and Praja means the populace. And it means not merely a human populace, but any sort of population, an animal population or a plant population or whatever it is, you see. The Prajapatis are the lords of creation, as it is called. Now you see how all this imaging, as you come back from the transcendent awareness, is once again in the sort of, in the forms with which their minds were conditioned according to the popular beliefs of the day. This is where the trouble comes. Several of the popular beliefs, of course, do get cut out as being just unworthy of scripture. And some of the beliefs get refined and purified because, after all, as the person goes through the discipline which makes him the perfected holy one, he is able to free himself from so many illusions which belong to his day and age. But he can't go beyond that. He can't. Anyone and everyone, 100,000 years ago or today, can realize that transcendent awareness. There everyone is one. There is no question of equality about it or inequality. All these distinctions vanish altogether. You see? But the moment you start coming back out of that state of the total oneness, of the absolute oneness, and the moment differentiation starts, we are immediately subject to the limitations and conditions of our day and age. Because the universe as a whole keeps evolving, keeps growing, keeps changing. And so all expression must of necessity bear the stamp of that changing. In those days, it was put this way. In Palestine, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, it was put in another way. In the Islamic tradition, which came into being 6 centuries after Christ, it is put in another way. In the traditions of the people of Siberia, of the Americas, the Incas and the Aztecs and all the others, you see, you will find their own particular mythologies. These mythologies are the key to understand the mental processes and the conditioning of the minds of those people. Now, out of the divine persons, now of course here you have the very distinctively Hindu conditioning, the obvious influence of Hindu society. Out of the divine person's mouth came forth the Brahmins, out of his arms were made the Kshatriyas, the ruling class, out of his two thighs the Vaishyas, the merchant class, and from his feet came the Shudras, the workers. Well, obviously they would use this sort of formulation. If he talked in modern times, and if he wanted to put the same sort of thing in modern terms, we'll say out of his head came, whom shall we say, the conservatives, out of his arms came the labor members, etc. Wouldn't we? But these are the absurdities of the human mind. Now, it is very important to understand that this is how the world order, the spiritual world, and all the rest of it is presented. It is a vast, illusory picture. It's a fantasy. The whole lot is a fantasy. A fantasy which is an attempt to present something to the mind of man which bears some sort of correspondence to reality. This was the best that could be done. But the best that we can do at any time in our history is always illusory. Now this is what we have to bear in mind. The fact that it is illusory. Those people who realized did know that it was illusory. They did know that. that it was illusory, those who had realized, because they realized by negating all these illusions. This is the point to bear in mind very, very carefully. But the illusions control our lives and spoil our lives and make us go up blind alleys and whatnot, with consequent misery, confusion, fear, terror, and all the horror and suffering that affects mankind. Now I'm going to touch upon this last section of that same Upanishad, the 15th section. That is the first section. Now here, another sage, Rekva. Rekva was a member of the so-called lowest caste. He was a Shudra. He was known as Rekva with the cart. He may have been a dustman for all we know, you know, the dust cart he took about with him. And a great king comes to him to ask for wisdom. And he treats him with contempt and scorn and so forth, you see, just to try him out. But the king puts up with that and offers him his daughter in marriage, offers him pearl necklaces and so forth. Then Rekva says, perhaps you are earnest, and he imparts the divine wisdom to him, you see. It's very interesting how you find all these stories throughout the Upanishads. Now, Rekva asks the question. How and by what means does this self, Radhakrishnan has translated it as self, the word is Atma, and self is about the worst possible translation for the word Atma. Atma unequivocally stands for the state of transcendent awareness, of transcendent consciousness. I think I ought to give you the evidence for it. Here it is. It's in the Varaha Upanishad. And remember, Atma and Brahman are interchangeable words. One who knows his own Atma as Brahman, that is bliss and without duality and qualities, that is truth and absolute consciousness, is not afraid of anything. That which is consciousness alone, which is all-pervading, which is eternal, which is all-full, which is of the form of bliss, and which is indestructible, is the only true Brahman or Atma. There is the unequivocal statement that this ultimate reality is not out there or something mysterious apart from me. This psycho-spiritual reality which mankind has sought is your state of awareness. If one really knows that, not merely believes it in a brash way, that is the important point. Otherwise we merely get conceited and careless, you see. But one really sees that, you will find that all fear will go completely out of your life. Believe me, that is absolutely true. If you really see that this transcendent, ultimate fact, truth, reality about what we commonly call one's own being is your own transcendent state of consciousness, you see, and is no power or being or entity outside you, And by that same token, it is not a power or being or entity inside you. See, this duality, this eternal divorce between parts of one whole, that is clean out. And when that goes out, all fear goes out. The fundamental fears. So now, that is Atma. So, we'll come back to this. Sir, he asks, how and by what means does this Atma, which is a mass of intelligence, this transcendent consciousness is equated with mass of intelligence. Now obviously a mass of intelligence is a phrase. You can see from the verbal formulation that it's impossible to formulate it. But it will do to just sort of give the feel of Atma, the transcendent consciousness. After moving upwards, burn away its seat. This is the question. How and by what means does this Atma, which is a mass of intelligence, after moving upwards, burn away its seat? What is the meaning of the seat there? That in which Atma is rooted. There's a marvelous, well, there are two or three such references in the Rig Veda, talking of the absolute reality. The earth is his footing. And you find in the Psalms, the earth is the footstool of the Lord. The earth is its footing. Earth meaning manifestation. You see? So that Atma, the seat of Atma in this case, is you yourself, the living person. You yourself, the living person as a whole, are the soil in which is rooted this transcendent awareness. Alright. How does it, moving upwards means becoming free of all the veils that cover it? You and I at this moment certainly are not in a state of transcendent awareness, obviously. Isn't that so? Alright. Now, in order that that transcendent awareness may be in its, see how language becomes difficult? I use language which inevitably makes it a finite thing. How that transcendent awareness can be unobstructedly present through the living being which bears your name. Put it that way. You see? This is the question. Actually. Right. Now notice the answer. And this is absolutely terrific. To him, God the Father replies thus. This Atma burns. Prana, apana, vyana, udana, samana, meaning the different forms in which the life force expresses itself. You see? And then there are several other Sanskrit terms also, all of which stand for the essential manifestations of the life force as such. It burns them. Now notice the word burn there. That is a correct translation, perfectly correct translation. It burns earth, water, fire. How do you burn fire? You see why I said earlier that these elements, the names of the elements so-called, stand also for states of consciousness. It burns these states of consciousness. The negating, in other words, the negating process is so complete that all this is utterly done away with. It's a process of refinement, of subtilization, until everything that is of the nature of the limited and the particular has completely vanished in the end. This is the point about it. water, fire, air, and akasha. It burns the waking, dreaming, and sleeping states. Now, in this context, dreaming and sleeping states do not mean sleeping when the body falls asleep and where you are just blotto. It doesn't mean that at all. The dreaming and sleeping states, the deep sleep states, refer to the use of what we commonly call creative imagination. And in this process of creative imagination, we use the material of our everyday experience and knowledge. And this is the dreaming state, as it is called. And when that activity subsides, and there is a state of passive alertness, pure awareness as such, you see, just nothing but a state of sensitivity to the nature of reality. That is your deep sleep state, which is referred to in all yoga. These are things which are very unknown. People don't know what it is all about. And then, finally, the fourth state, the turiya. These are known as the avasthas, these four. Sleeping, dreaming, the waking, dreaming, sleeping, and the fourth state, which they call the transcendent state. You see? The turiya state. But it burns that also. The transcendent, in this case, in the sense of the particular individual, still functioning as a particular being, sort of, if one may use a symbolical phrase, swimming in the sea of the transcendent. It just sort of springs to my mind at once, so I should say it. Turiya. This mighty world and the other world. This world that we perceive through our senses, the other world which is product of our imagination and our mental processes. This psycho-spiritual world which each one of us manufactures. Then, it burns the visible and the invisible worlds. The word world throughout the Upanishads almost always refers to states of consciousness. They call them worlds, entering this world, that world, the lower world, the higher world, the heavenly world. These are states of consciousness, actually. It burns virtuous and vicious conduct. It burns virtuous and vicious conduct. Thereafter, it burns the world devoid of luster, devoid of limit, devoid of appearance, shape, form, structure, any sort of manifestation. It burns the unmanifested. You know, the conceptual mind cannot possibly form any conceptions of all this. This is totally beyond all conceptualizing. It can be affirmed because you can experience it. But it is an experiencing which completely defies putting within the limited bounds of knowledge or of knowability. It burns the imperishable. Look at the language used. Self-contradictory terms have to be used now. You can't escape them. It burns death. That's why I read that first section, that the divine person creates death. And this Atma, this ultimate transcendent awareness, burns death. Therefore it burns birth. Therefore all mortality is out. And when all mortality is out, what is there but non-mortality, immortality. And this is the only real meaning of immortality, that you yourself, here and now whilst alive, can realize in actual experiencing the immortal state. And then this last sentence in this connection: death becomes one with the radiant supreme. You know, that is one of the most marvelous things I have ever seen in any scripture of the world. I mean, just that, this process of negation. First, the derivation of this world and my state here and now, subject to misery, suffering, fear, ignorance, delusion, illusion, conflict, folly, also the pleasant things, the joyful things, the ecstatic things, and all the rest of it. And then he works through the whole Upanishad. This whole Upanishad is a most marvelous thing to study. And then this is the final. Death becomes one with the radiant supreme. Now, in the supreme, there is neither existence nor non-existence. No existence and non-existence. This is the doctrine leading to liberation. This is the doctrine of the Veda. This is the doctrine of the Veda. In the earlier sections, he adds another sentence: this is the doctrine of Nirvana. So now you see, consider this very deeply. Do consider it very deeply. Consider it not merely with the mind, not merely with your feelings. Consider it with your total being. Consider it without believing, without disbelieving. Consider it by keeping yourself just open, utterly open, no barriers, sensitive to the truth. And you see, if you can do that with the necessary intensity, then right from inside yourself, without the brain knowing anything about it and the mental processes knowing anything about it, there will be completely burnt out the root of delusion, of ignorance, of therefore of illusions, therefore of fear, therefore of greed and hate and all the rest of it. They'll go out and you will be liberated. You'll be a human being in the pure and utter sense of the word. You must do it without desiring a result, because this is pleasant, because this is good, because this is wonderful. No, not that way, because that, as long as that is in the mind, it is the thing that taints and sullies this receptive, responsive sensitivity, through which alone that transcendent real can come and make its abode in you. You know, in the Gita, Sri Krishna says, I am the abode of Brahman and imperishable bliss. That is what you are. I think you will understand and bear with me that ever since September, for weeks and weeks, fortnight after fortnight, I have been concentrating on this thing, haven't I? But you see, this is absolutely at the very root of it all. what is the point in trying to sort of tackle bits and bobs of our personal problem or the world problem? You get to the root of it and the whole job is done at once. The powerhouse, for example, supplies electricity to all our houses, doesn't it? If you have your finger on the main switch in the powerhouse, you don't have to go around 500,000 houses turning the switches on. Just one switch, light. Just like that. Therefore, get this one thing. You'll find your whole being absolutely filled with peace, an utterly blissful peace. You'll know the real meaning of bliss, of fulfillment, and you will know what love and wisdom are. The brain will be quiet then. And the quietude of the brain is something which almost one may call a superhuman achievement, a superhuman realization. You know why? Because the actual physical brain is so structured that it contains throughout our life the very root of discord, trouble, illusion, and so forth. I mean, this is a scientifically known fact that our brain has, as Dr. McLean, I think, presented it, a certain reptilian aspect. The actual structure, the cell structure is that. A mammalian, lower mammalian aspect, and this neocortex, the top layer of brain cells here, you see, which during the last 500,000 years have completely outrun in development the other parts of the brain. So we are born lopsided. In a sense, one could say that that is the meaning of the Catholic, we are born in a state of sin. We've got the reptile in us, and the reptile is, think of a crocodile. The lower mammal, think of a horse, and the neocortex, you and I today, the best part of us. But all three are in us. Now the horse is a wonderful animal. You can train it, you can tame it, you can train it, you can cooperate with it, you can trust it, and all the rest of it. There can be a wonderful relationship of harmony. The lower mammal in us, you see, but this reptile in us. Have you ever had tea with a crocodile? No. You see, we are born that way. Now you will see the significance, the meaning of this process of purification and what it means, what it implies. The process, the reason, you'll see the reason why all the great teachers of the world emphasized morality. What did they teach actually? You look at the actual scriptures. What are they always talking about? Don't hurt. Don't steal. Don't run away with your neighbor's wife. Don't tell lies, etc. Don't give way to harsh speech, scandalous speech, and so on. A great deal about speech, because the talking part of the brain is the most important faculty that we have. Our friend the crocodile and our very dear friend the horse can't do either. But you and I can. So now you see why I go to this again and again. This root of the whole thing. If one wanted to present it in theistic terms, one could. But I don't know, and I mean I don't know, whether it is possible in terms of the theologies of the theistic religions to present it like this. If you reinterpret the theologies of the theistic religions with the help of the Upanishads and the Buddha's teaching, then you've got it at last. And mind you, the theistic religions definitely help understanding the Upanishads and the Buddha. They are all one. Reality is only one total reality. Truth is only truth. You can't have contradictory truths. Then they're not truth. And you see, life will become absolutely wonderful. Which does not mean that the external shape and form of the process of world events will be to our liking. No, never. It won't. The transformation will be in our mind and awareness. You see, now one of the meanings, perhaps, and we have touched upon other meanings in past meetings through the years, of Jesus' words, "Love ye one another as I have loved you." He who can awaken another human being is the true lover, the true friend. Sri Krishna talks of himself as the lover and the friend. The Buddha talks of himself as the good friend. This is what they mean. Now, if one can really sort of see this, and this wonderful burning takes place. This is the burning bush of Moses. The burning of all the beliefs, ideas, the lesser and greater and profounder and not so profound states of consciousness, and everything is burnt away. Which means that you are utterly free. You free yourself completely from any sort of domination by the ideas and so forth. Just hold yourself completely open, quiet, alert. And in that quiet, alert, total openness, total wide awakeness, the burning goes on by itself. And out of that burning bush, the voice of God answers and says, "I who am hath sent you." Then, whatever particular techniques one may use, particular things one may do, like retiring to a room because one feels like it and just sits quietly in meditation, as we call it. Or, if you like, the theistic form, in deep silent prayer. That's the same thing. Deep silent prayer is no other than the reality of meditation. You see, then the whole thing will have significance and pure meaning. Otherwise, my meditation, my deep silent prayer will be a selfish thing. I will only be pampering this selfness inside me and blowing this petty little self into a super self. Which is just silly, stupidity. And you see another natural result which will come. Not because you seek the result. If you seek it, it won't come. But another natural result which will just come. We are so concerned with the affairs of the world. We are so concerned with the affairs of our own household and so forth, of our own business, of our own particular professional work, as lawyers, doctors, teachers, whatever it may be, as dustmen, as whatever it may be. You see, we are so concerned with that. We want to change it this way, we want to change it that way. But I, the one who wants to change it, is an imperfect, impure, fearful, ignorant, stupid fellow. I can only change it in an imperfect, stupid, ignorant, silly way. I haven't got the power to do it rightly. This is the point. You see? But when one is free from this root falsity, this root misconception, you see, and the inside is pure, you'll have no option but to spread that purity and perfection to the total outside. And one of the signs that the inside is working purely will be that you will not make specific plans, specific blueprints to solve a specific problem in the household or around you. You will be alert and awake here and now in the immediate moment, giving the whole of yourself to it, and whatever emerges then will be the best possible under the circumstances. There is nothing else we human beings can do. The rest is all stupidity and conceit and sorrow making. So you see how religion works. By negating ill, then the glory of God shines, as the theists would say.